We've all heard about the Internet of Things, and I hope I'm not generalizing too much, but I think many of us will focus on Nest thermostats or the counting of our steps and the like. Well, today we'll be digging into what it means to integrate AI into a complex system that's actually built around the Internet of Things, and meaning in this case, sensors. We'll be talking about streaming data, where machine learning adds value, and where we need humans and what skills they'll bring. We've got a great guest, so stay tuned for some really interesting insights around the industrial Internet of Things. I'm John Pryle, and welcome to the Impact Podcast. With us today is Drew Conway, CEO of Alluvium.
Hi, it's great to be here.
So, what does Alluvium do?
What we do is put machine learning to work inside complex industrial operations with a real focus on how software can support and enhance the work of the men and women who work inside these big complex industrial systems.
We've heard a lot about the Internet of Things. You know, obviously, it's all about more data. And people think about it on the social side, all that data that's being gathered, or they think about it on the personal side, you know, thermostats, their learning and the like. But for us, I think we're going to be focusing on the application of sensors to improve the operations of businesses. Some are clearer to me, you know, ag tech has sensors in the soil and they get data via drones. So we got sensors more and more gathering all kinds of data around manufacturing processes and machinery. And you use the term industrial operations. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, so you know, I think about an industrial operations, and a useful metaphor for this is to just think about any complex system, right? So any complex system is this sort of high dimensional problem of many different inputs contributing to one or more different outputs. And so a complex industrial operation is a system or collection of machines, or you know, an oil refinery in the Gulf of Mexico that is set up to produce an output based on many, many different kinds of input.
Okay. Could you please talk to me a bit more just about the complexities of all this data and what it is that you're able to do with it?
From a data perspective, that's a fascinating place to be building software, right? Because artificial intelligence, machine learning, kind of intelligent systems are really good at doing is taking these high dimensional input spaces, lots of different kinds of sensor data, lots of different kinds of metadata, and those things being produced all the time and turning them into much lower dimensional problems or outputs, I should say, in terms of data that can then be leveraged by people.
When we think about what all this data is and how it comes to us and how we get it, it really is something quite different, yes?
You know, these systems don't exist in a data center. So this is not Google's problem. This is not Facebook's problem, right? All of their data is generated inside of software. And so it's sort of natively able to be stored. But if you have a well site sitting out in the Rocky Mountains and it's producing terabytes of data every day, you have to think critically about how you're going to pipe that data to some storage layer. I think the interesting innovations that are coming, and I'll say, you know, at Alluvium, we're very much focused on this in terms of the core technology, is how do you actually take that big pipe of data that exists in the system and is being generated in real time and learn from it as it's being generated? And so there's some really interesting machine learning problems that exist in there. You know, how do you do unsupervised learning from heterogeneous, structured and unstructured data inside an environment that is heavily constrained both computationally and by bandwidth? And, you know, that sort of box is where we think a lot about the kind of software that we're building. And then on a product side, how do you take whatever comes out of that distillation of data into information and build products that are actually useful for people?
Okay, but not to be rude, but some of that's just basic infrastructure, data management. But once you have it all, where can you go with it?
So this has been a great learning process for us as a company, but we take a very specific viewpoint on that. And we think a lot about the stability of that operation. And stability for us really forms the core both metric that we want our customers to focus on is kind of a, you know, the thing that we're building, and also the kind of value proposition of the software and the products that we deliver. In some sense, so stability and kind of the stability score is what we do, and in some sense is what Alluvium is known for. And the reason that we focused on that is one of the challenges, I think, as you're alluding to, is there's just so many different problems that you could think about solving inside of an industrial system, right? the kind of canonical one that comes up a lot is this idea of predictive maintenance, right? How do you optimize the use of a high capital asset, or how do you prevent them from failing? And we thought a lot about that, and you can certainly go deep on that specific case, and there's lots of great companies that do that. But what we found is there's really two sides to problems that exist inside industrial operations, and maintenance and asset optimization is only one of them. And oftentimes you get stuck in thinking about preventing failure when in reality, failures are not that common, right? So one of the challenges for any, I think, AI business or kind of machine learning based business is you often get stuck in trying to find use cases for rare events, right? And there's a really nice parallel to this, say in like the cybersecurity world, you try to show value by preventing, you know, threat vectors or hacks or things that for most companies are still fairly rare. In some sense, maybe are in a better position in the work that we do, because for customers who do complex industrial operations, there is a everyday moment-to-moment need to know that your operations are stable, right? Because stability means that you're producing the thing that you want to produce all the time, every day.
Within some operationally acceptable parameters?
Exactly. And then also kind of trending those up as much as possible. The thing that's been really interesting to us as we've kind of gone through the early stage startup, you know, kind of trial by fire and education that we've had, is that the companies that we work with are incredibly good at producing the thing that they're meant to produce. That is, of course, prima facie going to be true. That's why they do that. They have a tremendous amount of, you know, institutional knowledge around the operation that they're doing. It's, you know, refining oil, which is this, you know, petrochemistry and mechanical engineering that goes into that. It takes people decades and decades to master. But when you start understanding the processes through kind of stability analysis, and what that means for us is kind of taking this macro view of this complex system and kind of distilling it down into metrics that allow you to identify small changes that may be the result of some complex interaction of underlying sensors and mechanics, those insights are really where you get to see the power of kind of blending the strength of machine learning, which is to be able to observe data and identify patterns and kind of parse that out, and the strength of human expertise, which is then interpret that and help the system better understand what it's seeing.
Rather than an input and an output, you actually, and yeah, there's people monitoring that there's no leaks coming out of a thing and the bolts are tightened down, but no one's really necessarily taking the machine learning approach and the AI approach to each of the metrics along the way.
That's exactly right. And so part of that is some of the kind of basic data structure stuff that you want to get out of any given, you know, kind of data set that goes into a process. You know, what are the expected bounds of some reading? You know, simple things like, well, if this is a pressure sensor, then we know there shouldn't be any negative values. And so, if we see a negative value, what does that mean? Right?
Run away.
Yeah. Or suddenly the refinery is in outer space or something. We don't know what's going on. What can the human expert bring to an interpretation of some output that is novel and the machine learning would have never been able to know ex ante? And again, it's that blending. Oftentimes around the company, we talk about this kind of a golden braid that we try to focus on, where there's the machine learning itself, which is just good at kind of this dimensionality problem. There's the product, which should be able to reveal that to the user. And then there's the user themselves, which contain in their kind of brains and their institutional memory how to interpret the first two to make them all work together.
And I've seen you use the term, I'm not sure if it was a presentation or something you wrote, but you used the term human-centric AI. Can you explain that a little more then?
Yeah, so it kind of gets right to what we were just talking about. There's, you know, human-centric for us is both the attribute of both the products that we build and who we are as a company, and then technically what the machine learning and the technology under the hood does. So on the machine learning side, you know, the systems that we build are unsupervised or semi-supervised. So what that means is it doesn't know anything about the data that's looking at until it sees it for the first time. And then from these streams of sensor data or historical data that it's observing, it starts to build up an internal representation, in our case, of say how stable a pressure sensor reading is, or a thermal sensor is, or a rotary or power consumption sensor is. And then when it starts to see something that's changing, it reaches back out to the user and says, what am I looking at? Is this important? Is this not important?
Is this a fair human in the loop?
Exactly.
Okay.
Great. So this becomes the kind of semi-supervised approach that really helps the any given kind of deployment of product start to narrow in and refine toward a specific use case. Because you can always start with this kind of general approach, but a general approach is not going to solve your problem. You need to get closer and closer to exactly how an expert would interpret these things. But then on the user side, you know, human centric to us means we build software that is there to augment and empower the operator. I think there are several approaches now, I think, particularly in the industrial space, that have a kind of master algorithm flavor to them, that we can kind of apply general purpose AI to any number of problems, and that ultimately we can automate away a lot of the human in the loop and human decision making and human interpretation that these organizations and these industries have relied on for, you know, decades or hundreds of years.
Obviously, your reference to automating away jobs goes back to the first industrial revolution. But now you're talking about it in the context of artificial intelligence, where the role of humans might remain quite critical. Now, was the model you just described of eventually automating away these humans in the loop, was that something that works?
What we have found is that is exactly the wrong approach. A, because you set yourself up for worse, you know, technical interpretation, but also building systems that these customers trust is just as big a challenge as solving for the technical problem. And showing a customer that the product's actually there to enhance their workflow is a very powerful and very important thing.
This is great because this is obviously the next topic then is bias. And people often think about it from a social perspective because people could relate to that. They often forget, I don't know why, but they would often forget that bias doesn't have to be inherent in technology. There's interesting examples of sequential bias in just businesses. It has nothing to do with the traditional social biases that may or may not exist in the world, but even some things within business that are there. But so you could have source data that could be biased. And I view that more as social. And I'm not sure there's bias source data when you're monitoring in an IoT world. So I'd love to get your thought about where the elements of bias can happen in this kind of IoT space.
Well, I think for me, one of the important things that, you know, folks should recognize is that all data is biased. And, you know, I take a specific example in the IoT space. Some engineer that you don't know, I don't know, decided to put a sensor on an asset somewhere and you don't know why. And so there was some reasoning, some bias, and, you know, we think of bias as this kind of universally pejorative term, but bias can also mean that they're an expert, and so they know the best place to put it. But you don't know that, and so all the data that we get is biased by some design decisions that some other engineer that we can no longer ask questions to did, and now we're left with trying to interpret that data. And so it exists all over the IoT space. But the only way to attempt to kind of correct for that, or not necessarily correct for that because that implies it's wrong, but to kind of deal with that is to be able to reach out to people who are closer to those decision makers and are closer to having some intuition or context for why those decisions were made, right? So, you know, one of the interesting things about Alluvium as a company is we're all engineers, right, of some flavor or another, kind of from, you know, data scientist to full stack engineer to, you know, low level systems engineer and kind of all within those dimensional scales. What none of us are folks who have an industrial background. You know, nobody's sitting at this company today ever before they started working here ever spent any time walking around an oil refinery or an oil rig or a manufacturing center. And so what that means is, at first glance, perceived as a real weakness for us, what it means is that we have to take as a first class approach building software that can be related to and draw inference from those experts, because we know that that's the only way to approach getting over this kind of bias, both in terms of the data generating process and in terms of the analysis process.
And in terms of then being transparent about what you do, what type of transparency do you believe you need to share with the customers?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think something that we continue to think about evolving in the products. So, you know, not to be too specific on just specific products that we build, but we have one product now, which we call Alluvium Primer. This is our newest flagship product that we're building. It's actually focused not in a streaming environment, but in a forensic environment. So retrospective looking. And part of the reason why we built it is we recognize that some of the biggest barriers to entry for us as a company were not technical, but institutional. That a lot of the, you know, big industrial companies, you know, multinational, large bureaucratic organizations were just not necessarily comfortable with having a small startup drop new technology into their critical infrastructure systems, even if it was for a pilot or for a kind of closed thing. But what they were comfortable with doing is having us analyze historical data. And I mention this because the product itself is designed to both introduce this idea of stability analysis, but then allow the customer to kind of iteratively walk down a tree to get to the base level of data analysis where they can then see the exact values that they're used to seeing from the systems that produce those, and then see how our product generated the stability analysis that it did based on those numbers. And so for us, we build a product that provides an obvious value to our customers, this kind of AI-assisted forensic analysis tool. But there's this secondary, and I would say almost as important benefit that our customers get and we get as a company, is it helps them build trust with the underlying algorithm, right? That, you know, AI as a kind of commercial product is a black box, right? I don't expect my customers who are, you know, energy producers, oil and gas executives, and folks working inside of industry to understand all the underlying technology that we're using. They shouldn't. But what we do want to be able to do is build products that allow their users to unpack that black box just enough so that they can understand and see where we went to get to the answer that we did and build that trust. Because once you have that trust, then it becomes this kind of iterative process.
And I like the thought. And I really hadn't thought, I always thought transparency was about, here's our new results. Let me prove to you why I got there. Actually, I like the thought of saying, look, we're very transparent. Let's go look at, let's take a historical view. Let's take a forensic view and get a, and if together you and I, your customers and you agree that this is the right analysis, then you've really got a level of confidence that you're doing a good job. Give me a view of kind of the natural science skills and the social science skills as all this comes together in these new generations of solutions.
As you've already sort of seen, I have strong opinions on this. And so my feeling is that social scientists make the best data scientists. And I think part of that is your training as a social scientist is, you know, not to be overly general, is sort of two big things. One, be skeptical of almost everything that you see and read and are shown through some analysis, right? This whole idea of bias in the data generating process is something that has its roots in kind of early quantitative approaches to social science, because, you know, if you're doing survey design and you go out and ask people a question, it becomes very obvious very quickly that depending on how you write your questions, you're going to get different results. And so there's bias in that data generating process. So you're taught at a very and very early part of your training as a social scientist to always think about that data generating process. I think the other thing that is ultimately becoming maybe kind of the coin of the realm for data science is how to understand and interpret human decision making, right? You know, this would be totally outside the work that we do at Alluvium, but there are, you know, thousands and thousands of data scientists who are employed at companies that really want to understand why someone clicks on a thing, right? Or why someone buys something, or, you know, why someone goes somewhere. And all of those questions start with a someone. And that someone is a person making a choice. And, you know, you can pick your discipline in the social sciences. I picked political science because the thing that I was most interested in is how do groups of people make choices? And that's really the core of what political science is. What is collective action? Why do groups of people make decisions? Why do groups of people decide to elect one person versus another? Why do countries go to war with each other? These are all collective actions that people, that humans take. And what I have found is that training has served me incredibly well throughout my career in thinking about core data science problems, because the underlying technology, you know, obviously there's a range of aptitude for someone's ability to kind of learn how to code or, you know, learn linear algebra and be able to interpret the results. But I think, at least in my opinion, is that those are much more easily trained and almost autodidactically acquired skills rather than this kind of social science training, which I think is much harder to pursue and requires more formal training to be able to kind of go out in the world and achieve. So I have said for a long time that I think data scientists who come from a social science background, while they are not, those are not the skills that are often listed in a job spec for data science. You'll see people, you know, PhD requirement in physics, computer science, statistics, things like that. And those people are brilliant and they make great data scientists. The folks that I've worked with who come from a social science background, I think exceed in places where those folks often struggle to, and they ultimately make really, really fantastic data scientists.
That's great. Drew Conway, CEO of Alluvium, thank you so much for taking the time with us.
That was great fun. Thanks for having me.
Streaming data. Keeping your eyes on the prize and recognizing the roles humans play with their business knowledge. Oh, and think about what it means to augment data science skills with a little social science background. A great discussion. My thanks again to Drew Conway of Alluvium for the Impact Podcast. I'm John Pryle.